Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Jessen, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of our audio recording, I will say that today's date is October 27, 2021. This panel of the court today has six cases on its agenda, one of which will be submitted with oral argument and five of which will be submitted without oral argument. The one case set for oral argument is a consolidated case beginning with A19-112. The case name is In Re Denial of Contested Case Hearing Requests and Issuance of NPDES/DSS Permit Number MN0071013. I think as everyone knows, it concerns a permit issued by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to Polymet Mining, Inc. Counsel have helpfully apprised the court by email of their division of argument time, and I'm not sure if the emails we receive also reflect the order, but I'll leave that to you. And just to reiterate, and for those in the gallery who may be unaware, the court previously granted a motion to expand oral argument time to allow relators, three sets of relators, 30 minutes of argument time for their principal arguments instead of 15. The court granted respondents 35 minutes of time to be divided between the Pollution Control Agency and Polymet, rather than 15, and then the court also granted relators 15 minutes of rebuttal, which may be a record in the history of the Court of Appeals. I'm not sure, 15 minutes of rebuttal. But, and I understand that the three relators or sets of relators, the three counsel who have signed off on briefs will divide their 30 minutes evenly, 10, 10, and 10. And I understand that the two respondents will divide it almost evenly. The agency will take 18 minutes and the company, the permittee, 17 minutes. And then again, I believe relators are planning on dividing their rebuttal time evenly. So each of you will see a clock at the beginning. If you have your Zoom settings appropriately, you should be able to see a clock with a blue background, and that will tell you your time available. So each individual attorney arguing will have, I think, a fresh allotment of time showing on the clock. Are there any other preliminary matters that the lawyers wish to address? Okay, hearing none, then I will say the first relator's counsel to present your argument. You may do so. Please identify yourself and your client or clients at the beginning. You may proceed.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Elise Larson, and I represent the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness, and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Today, the relators have divided their time by issue. So I'm going to use my 10 minutes to discuss those issues governed by Minnesota state law. Ms. McAbee is going to cover those issues that are governed by the Federal Clean Water Act. And Mr. Murdoch is going to cover those issues as they directly relate to the interests of the Fond du Lac Band. With regard to my time this morning, I'd like to devote my time to three issues. First, my client's entitlement to a contested case hearing. Second, the violation of the groundwater rules. And last, MPCA's deviations from its prior norms and practices. Beginning with the contested case hearing, this court must reverse and remand MPCA's decision to deny my client's petition because its decision is not supported by substantial evidence. Now, we set forth in our briefs numerous issues where MPCA failed to support its decision, but given the tight timeline this morning, I would like to focus on the bentonite issue. And that's
Larson,
because
before you proceed, I just want to make a statement on behalf of the court. Even though counsel have divided their time in that way, I don't wish for the judges of the court to be limited in what questions they may ask of which attorneys. It may be not feasible for us to keep in mind these different divisions. It also may be that we, you know, have a question based on the briefing that a lawyer did on a particular issue that's not divided, as you say. So I just want to make that clear at the beginning that judges may interject with questions about any issue for any lawyer. Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the Supreme Court held in NorthMet 2 that there is not substantial evidence to show that the bentonite amendment will work. And the record shows that MPCA relied on the exact same evidence and that the bentonite amendment was critical to their permitting decisions. Now, respondents' only argument for why the Supreme Court's decision is not dispositive is that MPCA does not apply the reactive mine waste rule. But MPCA's rules are substantially similar to DNR's when it comes to confirming that this project is going to be able to comply with the law and that the engineering controls can operate as designed. Here, MPCA set forth in its fact sheet that the bentonite amendment is one of the engineering controls necessary for PolyMet to comply with the groundwater anti-degradation rules. And equally as important, the Goldsim modeling from the FEIS includes inputs that assume that the bentonite amendment will work. This modeling is critical to MPCA's assessment on numerous other issues, such as how much and how polluted will the water be under the tailings basin? Has the containment system been designed to handle that water? Has the wastewater treatment system been designed to handle that water? And when water escapes the containment system, how much and how polluted will that water be?
Ms. Larson, in reviewing the order denying the contested case hearing, I don't see any mention of the bentonite amendment. I mean, was that raised at the time in the motion or petition for contested case hearing? Was that clearly presented to the agency?
Yes, Your Honor. We directly raised the bentonite amendment in our petition, and I can get you the page for that on reply if that would be helpful. But we specifically cited the bentonite amendment as an engineering control that was not supported by substantial evidence. And MPCA's failure to acknowledge the fact that we raised that factual issue just goes to how deficient the MPCA's record is on this issue. Because there's not substantial evidence in the record showing that the bentonite amendment will work or that the other issues that we addressed have been supported by substantial evidence, this court should reverse and remand for a contested case hearing.
Ms. Larson, can I just clarify a distinction, make sure I understand your argument? You're not claiming that the NorthMet decision is precedential for us with regard to the issue. Your point being is that because in answer to Judge Johnson's question, it had been specifically requested that we would review it in relation to the discretion the agency has on whether to hold a contested case hearing.
Our position, Your Honor, is that the MPCA relied on the exact same information that DNR relied on, and the Supreme Court has already held that the evidence that was presented does not show that the bentonite amendment will actually work. And so factually, neither PolyMet nor PCA has pointed to any other evidence that MPCA relied on. And therefore, that factual decision is dispositive here.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions on the contested case hearing, I'd like to move on to the groundwater issue. This court must reverse and remand MPCA's decision to issue this permit because it violates Minnesota's groundwater law. In Minnesota, we protect groundwater to the maximum level. Chapter 7060 provides that all groundwater is to be protected and sets rules to prevent groundwater pollution. Now, MPCA has failed to comply with the groundwater rules when it permitted two disposal facilities that pollute the soil underneath the disposal site and then purposefully draw the water below the water table. In Minnesota, we do not allow disposal systems that purposefully pollute 2,000 acres of groundwater without evidence that the pollution is necessary. Here, there are no such findings. Rather, the record shows that there are alternatives in the form of liners and leachate collection systems that would protect our groundwater. For this reason, this court must reverse and remand the permit and require PolyMet to design systems for the Category 1 stockpile and the tailings basin that do not violate Minnesota's groundwater law.
Ms. Larson, am I correct that you're relying on 7060.600 subpart 1? And if so, that applies to discharges by means of injection wells or other such devices. I mean, are those the facts of this case? The discharge that you're referring to, does it satisfy that rule, if that's the rule you're relying on?
Yes, Your Honor, we rely on both subparts 1 and subpart 2. With regard to subpart 1, we do submit that this is an injection. An injection means to draw water or to move something, which is the definition, frankly, that PolyMet cites as well with regard to what injection means. The point of the inward hydraulic gradient here, Your Honor, is to direct the water to move below the water table. This is a system that has been designed so that water is going to percolate through the Cat 1, the stockpile or the tailings basin, go into the unsaturated zone, and then that water is going to be drawn below the water table purposefully. And that's precisely the kind of system and design that subpart 1 is intended to prevent.
So, Ms. Larson, if you may, I think PolyMet and the MPCA, though I'm sure they'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, seem to be saying, look, we don't need a permit here because our permits overall, you know, we don't need to address this because our overall permit forbids discharges to groundwater. I think in the permit, that was something that was added after the draft permit towards the very end, but I may be wrong about that. Could you address that argument for me?
The argument that this does not discharge to groundwater is factually incorrect. If you look at PolyMet's own engineering drawings, you can see that the disposal site discharges into the water table. And so really MPCA's argument amounts to that water underneath disposal sites does not count for the purpose of Minnesota's groundwater rules. And when you look at the groundwater rules, it is explicit that all groundwater is governed by these rules. There is no exception for groundwater that is underneath a disposal site that somehow that can be polluted by a discharger. I see that my time is running out. I do want to point out, and perhaps we will get to the procedural violations, but we do believe that MPCA's conduct that we investigated at the district court did amount to unlawful procedures and arbitrary and capricious conduct that also requires a remand here. And perhaps someone else will get an opportunity to argue those claims. But for the foregoing reasons, we do submit that Minnesota state law requires
I'm sorry, Ms. Larson, maybe I interrupted you, but I guess, can you be specific about which procedures were unlawful and then what exactly, what type of remand instructions would you want this court to order if we were to agree with you?
Thank you, Your Honor. The procedures that are unlawful is that the district court found that MPCA violated the Official Records Act, they violated their own data management manual, and that they failed to implement a litigation hold, which resulted in an inadequate record before this court. Failing to follow your own manual and rules about how you preserve the record is an unlawful procedure under 14.69C, requiring a reversal and remand. We also submit the alternative argument that was raised by relators is that the record plainly shows that MPCA deviated from its prior norms and practices when it made this request to EPA, and that it failed to show its reasons for doing so in the record, and that is an arbitrary and capricious decision-making process and shows that the agency was exercising its will rather than its judgment.
Okay. If I may, Judge Johnson, may I follow up on your question?
Sure.
Ms. Larson, I think I want to follow up on Judge Johnson's question because I'm also concerned about, well, what should we direct the agency to do on remand? You know, speaking for myself, not for the panel, I mean, the issue of whether the agency pushed the EPA not to submit written comments regarding the lack of water quality based effluent limits. I mean, that's a at the concern, you all say that's a red flag. Should that be arbitrary and capricious? If the court went down that road, then what should we tell the agency to do? Do they, you know, not get the permit at all? Do we say reopen the comment period, let all the comments come in? If you could be more specific, and maybe not now, but perhaps on rebuttal, I think that would help the court.
Would you like me to respond now?
Yes, you may.
Our position is that this court should reverse and remand and reopen the comment period. From the publicly available OIG report, the EPA has indicated that if the comment period is reopened, that EPA, if necessary, is going to submit written comments on the permit, and that would cure the irregularities that occurred in this case. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Larson. Next, the second relator's attorney, whoever that is, may introduce himself or herself and clients and begin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Paula Maccabee, and I represent Water Legacy. Our argument today is simple and very consistent with Ms. Larson's argument. The NorthMet permit must be reversed and remanded due to failure to protect surface waters as well as groundwater. First, MPCA erred in failing either to prohibit or to regulate pollution through groundwater that is the functional equivalent of direct surface discharge. Under the Clean Water Act, the U.S. Supreme Court Maui case, and the Minnesota Supreme Court U.S. Steel case, this error requires that the permit must be reversed and remanded. Second, MPCA erred in failing to set water quality-based effluent limits, that I'll call Q-bells because it's easier in oral arguments, for NorthMet direct surface discharge of sulfate, mercury, and other toxic metals. There isn't a single Q-bell in the permit. Our position is that MPCA lacked authority to substitute internal waste stream operating limits for enforceable Q-bells. The permit must be reversed. First, the Clean Water Act and Maui require reversal of the permit. The permit listed a number of NorthMet sources of pollution, including mine pits, waste storage, rock stockpiles, and the tailings basin. For each of these point sources, MPCA only prohibited direct discharge. That was an error of law under Maui and the Clean Water Act.
Ms. Maccabee, the response, as I recall, PolyMet and maybe the agency as well, is that the permit prohibits any discharge into the groundwater. And so therefore the Maui application would not apply, or the case would not apply in terms of the equivalence. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Two things. First, in response to the draft permit, Water Legacy asked the MPCA to prohibit discharge through groundwater. And MPCA specifically said in its responses to our comments that it had clarified the final permit only to prohibit direct discharge. And if you look at the permit on each of its pages where it names a point source, the only prohibition is for direct discharge. Now, both PolyMet and MPCA say that a generic boilerplate provision that wasn't in the MNTAC permit changes everything despite all these words. But that boilerplate provision prohibiting spills, it was in the MNTAC permit that was issued at the same time within just a few weeks of the NorthMet permit. And neither the court nor MPCA raised it as any kind of defense to the claim on Maui. Now, here's some really clear example. The clearest example, I think, is the South Tailings Basin seepage through groundwater. It's not prohibited. It's not required that it all be collected. And PolyMet admits that this seepage emerges through groundwater within a short distance. This seepage would be more than 20 times more sulfate, lead, copper, and nickel than water quality standards. This is a really clear example of how the permit was not designed with the Clean Water Act limitations in mind, does not prohibit discharge through groundwater, and does not ensure that that discharge won't have the potential to violate water quality standards.
No, just to clarify, Ms. McAbee, in my understanding of the Maui decision, it referencing discharge into groundwater that ultimately has the functional equivalent of reaching navigable waters. And I'm trying to understand the application of this here to prohibiting any discharge to the groundwater per the permit.
Your Honor, the record is undisputed that all the waters that would be affected by the North Mitt permit are navigable waters. And that includes the wetlands and creeks immediately surrounding the tailings basin and the Category 1 waste stockpile and the unlined peat disposal, as well as the rivers. And so if the discharge is going to get to those wetlands or creeks, it is a discharge that affects navigable waters. The question under Maui is, does the discharge through groundwater serve as the functional equivalent of a direct discharge, particularly for the unlined features like the tailings basin on the south side and on the north side? It's a short distance and a short time. MPCA's brief admits that for the Category 1, it would take 21 days for that seepage to get through the cutoff wall. Under worst case scenario, even on the north side of the tailings basin, it would take only 60 days. And there is no record anywhere in the EIS or in the permitting record saying how long it would take for that pollution in groundwater to get to the nearest wetland, the nearest place where pollution daylights to navigable waters. And that's why the Maui analysis is essential, because these critical questions about time and distance and the effects on the first navigable surface water, they're not in the permit. They weren't considered. The permit only dealt with direct discharge and let it go. And so under Maui, this permit reflects a clear error of law and needs to be reversed and remanded, as was the U.S. Steel permit.
If I may, Ms. McAbee, turning your attention back from the Maui analysis back to the reasonable potential analysis.
Yes.
Because when I read the Supreme Court's decision in Annandale, you know, they seem to talk about this broad nature of the phrase cause or contribute to the, you know, violation of the water rules, and just give the MPCA, as I read that decision, a lot of discretion. I think they say they can make a wide variety of policy choices to which we give a lot of deference. So how can we not just say, I mean, they did that analysis, right?
And Your Honor, Annandale is actually a case where Q-bells were required. And Annandale cited 122.4i, which says that in a general, discharge of pollution to impaired waters is prohibited. It is only permitted if there are Q-bells that set load limits. That was done in Annandale. It was done in the Alexandria Lake case. But here there are no Q-bells. So Q-bells are needed to set a limit on how much mercury, how much sulfate, both concentration and load, and then to determine if an offset is even possible the way it was in Annandale. And we would submit that an offset is not possible for mercury in the Embarrass River watershed, because the EIS is absolutely clear that the PolyMet project would increase mercury in the Embarrass River. In addition, the Annandale and the Alexandria Lake cases are also precedent for saying that the norm in Minnesota is for new discharge to establish Q-bells rather than just assume that treatment will work. And a couple other reasons, Your Honor, I know I'm running short on time. Are there other questions you'd like to follow up?
Yes. So, I mean, I differ a bit from your reading of the Annandale. I understand that. But one thing that I've struggled with, so we know, and it's in the record now, that in the letter from the EPA, which is read to the MPCA, where they said that in that letter that the permit needed Q-bells, as you call them, to, you know, comply with the Clean Water Act. We give deference to agencies. Is there some deferences due to the EPA for that? I mean, how do we factor that in? That's one of my questions for, I think, everyone.
Your Honor, Annandale itself relied on EPA interpretation of its regulations. And if you look at pages, I believe it's 321 and 322 of Annandale, they talk about EPA's interpretation as compelling evidence of what federal regulations mean. In this case, there are actually three regulators. There's the EPA, there's the MPCA, And then there's the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And the court needs to look at all of these and also to look at precedent. And so cue bells are needed because there are discharges to impaired waters. They're needed under the Great Lakes Initiative. And they're needed because operating limits are not enforceable. And simply having surface discharge one, which is on pages 350 to 354 of the permit, is the only place where limits are set. There are no limits for sulfate, and there's not even any monitoring for sulfate. And the limits for mercury and lead and arsenic and other toxic metals are far above water quality standards. Those limits in surface discharge one would be the basis for enforcement. And they would create a permit shield, so there would be no enforcement of excessive sulfate, excessive mercury, lead, or arsenic. And that is why this permit was made in error. It is necessary to reverse and remand, first for the Maui analysis to make sure that pollution through groundwater does not violate water quality standards, and also to make sure that the permit sets limits so that direct surface discharge of wastewater to impaired waters does not result in cause or contribution to violation of water quality standards. Now, this permit started out with an abnormal procedure, as Ms. Larson explained. It is important that this court take the opportunity to make sure that the outcomes of the permit are not deviant as well, and take the action that is needed, reversal and remand, to protect both Minnesota water quality and the integrity of Minnesota's regulatory process. Thank you very much. I see I've run out of time.
Ms. McAbee, I have one question. Going back to the EPA's draft letter, which was not mailed, but read, as I read it, and tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like the views expressed there do not directly attack or undermine the reasonable potential analysis, but seemingly suggest Q-bells nonetheless. In other words, the way the federal regulations are written, the agency, I think, must issue such, tell me if I'm wrong, but must issue Q-bells if there is a reasonable potential. If there's not a reasonable potential, does an agency such as PCA have discretion? And is that what EPA was urging the PCA to do, was to exercise discretion despite a lack of reasonable potential, or was the EPA questioning the reasonable potential analysis? And if you could point me to something in that document, I'd appreciate it.
Your Honor,
could refer to it, if not point to it.
Your Honor, I'm going to give you what I can do from memory, and then in rebuttal, I can give you the exact pages. The EPA said several things. The EPA said that having technology-based effluent limits that are so high without also having Q-bells would not achieve protection of water quality. That was not a specifically reasonable potential argument.
And that's probably not in dispute, but it's the operating limits that are in the permit that are the real mechanism for keeping pollutant levels low, right?
Well, two different things, Your Honor. First, the operating limits in the permit, the EPA said, are unlikely to be enforceable under the Clean Water Act. We've done additional research, and the case law in the Eighth Circuit says that internal waste stream limits are not enforceable. And how do we know these are internal waste stream limits? Because the permit says so in 10 different times.
I think you're referring to the Iowa League of Cities case.
Yeah, the Iowa League of Cities case, and that which cites the American Iron case, and none of the cases that.
I've read that case, and it seems to me it might stand for the proposition that if a permittee challenges an EPA action that is directed at an internal process, then the agency's statutory authority may not go there. But we got kind of the reverse situation here, where the permittee is not objecting to this internal, and in fact prefers it. It appears to the alternatives. And so, in other words, isn't the Iowa League of Cities really kind of like policing the boundaries of agency authority? But here, if the permittee does not challenge that, is the case really applicable?
Well, Your Honor, there are two different kinds lines of cases. One which says that internal waste stream limits are not enforceable under the Clean Water Act. And in this case, where Q-bills were feasible, very explicitly under the regulations, they're not authorized to replace Q-bills. There's also a line of cases in that Flambeau case in Sierra Club against IGC Hazard are important there, that if an agency has considered or contemplated a pollutant and has not set Q-bills, has not set limits, that is interpreted as saying they had the opportunity, for example, in Flambeau to set a limit, and they simply did not. So that is the other danger for enforcement. But get one more issue about the, you asked several questions. One more issue.
You're right. Go ahead. Go ahead and give me a reasonably full answer. I don't want you to feel like you can't answer what I asked, which probably was a compound question, and I apologize for that.
But Your Honor, these are all important questions. And getting back to what the EPA said, the EPA also said that the reasonable potential analysis that the MPCA did was not authorized under the Great Lakes Initiative or the Memorandum of Agreement with EPA, the amendment in the year 2000. What the EPA said is to project effluent using PolyMet's models, which are P90, which means they cut off the top 10% of pollution rather than P95, which only eliminates the top 5%. The EPA has said since back in 2013 that the statistics that PolyMet used in the EIS are not adequate for permitting. And so the EPA said not only are there some instances, impaired waters, mercury, and T-bills, where it is protective and recommended and necessary to use Q-bills, but that reasonable potential analysis done by MPCA was not the correct analysis. It was not authorized. And that matters because not only the projection of effluent, but the type, the concentrations of metals that go into the water tested for treatment are dependent on the modeling, which EPA said and relators have said is inadequate under the Great Lakes Initiative and unauthorized under the Memorandum of Agreement.
So I'm a little bit confused because I thought, I'm looking now through my papers for the regulation concerning GLI. I thought that it also called for a reasonable potential analysis.
Your Honor, reasonable potential analysis means different things. For example, the GLI for mercury, bioaccumulative toxins, says that reasonable potential is established when there is discharge of detectable mercury. It doesn't say there's no reasonable potential. And the prohibition on discharge to impaired waters, that prohibition is only lifted if there's a Q-bill that shows because of a load limit and a plan for compliance, there is no reasonable potential. Otherwise, the regulation just says adding pollution to impaired waters by a new discharger is prohibited because it will cause or contribute. So it's not that that reasonable potential is narrow. It's that it means different things if you have a bioaccumulative toxin in the Great Lakes. It means a different thing if there's impaired waters. And it means a different thing for the Great Lakes because the Memorandum of Agreement says when there isn't existing data on a case-by-case basis, you have to go with the GLI procedures and the EPA has to approve. And here, and I don't remember which page of the letter, the EPA said they didn't approve. They wanted the different analysis. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. McAbee. Does any other judge have a follow-up question for Ms. McAbee? It appears not. Thank you for your argument. Counsel for the third relator, the third attorney, may introduce himself and client and begin argument.
May it please the court. I am Matthew Murdoch for the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And if I may just start off addressing some of the questions that the panel has asked. To Judge Jessen's and Judge Johnson's question about the relief we seek, we do agree that at a minimum, the decision should be reversed for a republic notice of the permit. But the band's position is that MPCA needs to start from the beginning of the process because of the deficiencies that were identified in the permit application that we just don't know if they've been addressed. And they're very serious concerns because they go to the Maui analysis, the basic enforceability of the permit. And so we do think the band's position would be ultimately the relief we want is to go back to the permit application stage. If the court disagrees with that argument, at a minimum, it should be republic noticed. And one other question another question I'd like to address was Judge Sleater's about, there was a lot of discussion about this prohibition of discharges to groundwater. Of course, that does not prohibit discharges to surface water, which is a Clean Water Act, is the scope of coverage for the Clean Water Act. And so it's just a permit condition. So if it, you know, polluted wastewater is not going to obey a permit condition. And the problem with that is if PolyMet, if it's not happening how PolyMet says, and the water is actually going to one of these wetlands that's in close proximity to the mine site or the plant site, and they start doing this adaptive management and they comply with the terms of their permit, but that's not good enough, and it actually does discharge to navigable waters, that would be a permit shield issue, because they would have complied with both elements of a permit shield, which is one, they comply with the express terms of their permit, and two, that the discharge was within the reasonable contemplation of the permitting agency, and both those conditions would be met. And so just a state law prohibition on discharges to groundwater under state law authority is really not sufficient, because it raises this issue of a permit shield.
Mr. Murdoch, since you're willing to answer some of the questions we've already been asking other counsel, what do we make, you know, the big discussion is about EPA and the delay, and then this letter we're just referring to, and their concerns about WQ bells and et cetera. But nevertheless, the EPA has the option to, I think the phrase the district court used, and I've seen it in the briefing, veto the permit, and it chose not to. And given our deference to agency, and here I'll call it agency's decisions, what do we make of that non-veto, and notwithstanding the record supporting the back and forth between the agencies and discussing the permitting process from beginning to ultimate approval?
Your Honor, let me take the veto part first. EPA's objection, whether or not to object, is completely discretionary. And if it takes no action, that does not demonstrate approval of the permit. And EPA can decide not to object even if the permit does not comply with the Clean Water Act. And this court's decision.
Can I just clarify that? Is it my understanding, though, that it's a deference to the state agency to enforce a federal regulated permit? And hence, they would have an obligation, I assume, if they did not believe that it was complying with the federal regulations?
No, Your Honor. There is no obligation because of how discretionary EPA's decision to object is. It's not challengeable in federal court. The phenolic ban tried. It's so discretionary. There is no obligation for EPA to object even if it strongly believes that the permit does not comply with the Clean Water Act. But EPA exercises its oversight in lots of other ways, and the written comments are one way in which that EPA exercises oversight over MPCA's issuance of a NPDES permit, because it identifies, you know, EPA's basic interpretation of the Clean Water Act as applied to the permit. And that does go to Judge Jessen's question, which was about, well, what sort of deference do we show EPA? And, you know, we do lay this out in the beginning of our brief of, you know, MPCA's own position before this court in prior cases is that this court reverses MPCA if it deviates even slightly from EPA, because EPA ultimately administers the Clean Water Act with, you know, a couple exceptions for the Army Corps, but not really relevant here. But, you know, EPA exercises or administers the Clean Water Act. In the Iowa League of Cities case also, you know, notes this proposition that MPCA's discretion to issue a NPDES permit is exercised against a significant backdrop of EPA's authority. And so, you know, EPA's decision whether or not to have vetoed the permit here really doesn't carry much weight, because, you know, in this court decision and in re authorization to discharge, this court recognized that it has the veto authority, but that's not approval. That doesn't signify approval.
So, Mr. Murdoch, if I may, I apologize if this wasn't perhaps one of the areas you were planning on talking about, but it follows up on this. So we will overturn an agency decision at times or remand if there's this combination of danger signals that suggest that the agency hasn't taken a hard look at a difficult issue, right? I mean, that's our what we do on our arbitrary and capricious standard, I believe. Okay, here, when I look at it, I would say, for purposes of this argument, saying, look, pushing the EPA not to submit those written comments criticizing the lack of water quality based effluent limits, okay, if that's a danger thing, agreeing for these purposes, that's a danger signal, but that's one. And that's one thing, looking at an agency's actions across 15 years of or more of a regulatory process. How do we get beyond one possible danger signal to the sort of record, a combination of danger signals, which means we're going to reverse a state agency?
Your Honor, that was probably one of the more recent examples of that. You can go back to the EIS process of a danger signal, and that, you know, EPA had concerns about the NPDES permitting approach all the way back in the EIS process. And MPCA insisted that EPA, that those responses be deferred to the permitting process. And then we get to the permitting process, and then they insist that EPA not submit comments, and those concerns never come into the record. So it is a pretty long track record of MPCA sort of not wanting these very serious concerns by the ultimate oversight agency to be put out and have MPCA respond to them. And now we get all the way here, and MPCA is actually not even responding to EPA's comments. I mean, it's using what it achieved successfully with EPA's political appointees to just not even address these issues. And so there are quite a bit of danger signals. The other one we do identify in our briefing is what the MPCA has already told this court before the transfer. It said a lot of things. And at that point in time, you know, a lot of this stuff we now know wasn't public. It was either being withheld under FOIA within the EPA, or it was stuff that we found out in the transfer. So that's another, in the band's view, a very serious danger signal that, you know, why weren't they just upfront about this from the beginning? And this sort of, you know, they acted like people to hide because they did have something to hide. Why, if this was all above board, why weren't they just upfront about this from the beginning?
Mr. Murdoch, can I, following up on that point, we have kind of a unique situation here because of the 1468 proceeding, that we have district court factual findings that kind of get right to what you are talking about. And so my question to you is, however we might define irregularities, it seems, as I read in total, that the district court's findings that it was non-prejudicial in the end because the concerns of the EPA and the concerns of the realtors were all a part of the record and are part of the record in the ultimate permitting decision.
Your Honor, first, if I may, I think that prejudicial finding went to the spoliation issue. Of course, a finding of prejudice is clearly within this court's authority under 1469. So to the extent the district court made a finding on prejudice, that exceeded its jurisdiction. That, you know, it was simply to find facts, determine what the procedures were, what happened, and then this court was to decide prejudice. But it is prejudicial, highly prejudicial to the band. I mean, we don't know what the permit would look like had MPCA just followed the regular process, which would have had EPA's comments come in, MPCA would have had to respond to them, and that would have resulted in a permit. And we just don't know what that would look like now. And there's no way for MPCA to now claim that the procedural irregularities did not impact the ultimate outcome of the permitting decision. And just because I'm running out of time, you know, from the Fond du Lac's perspective, it is a downstream state. It is in an affected state here with federally approved water quality standards that are designed to protect band members exercising their treaty rights, subsistence fishing, and to maintain their cultural and religious traditions. So the fact that, you know, one of the issues EPA identified, if I may just finish very quickly, is compliance with the band's water quality standards. And that was one of the big issues EPA was pushing. And that is highly prejudicial that MPCA successfully kept that out of the record. Thank you.
Mr. Murdoch, I actually had a question about the band's water quality standards, because in your brief, you made an argument, I believe, that the permit does not protect those standards. And in you cite to statute or regs that refer to the water quality standards of the state or another state. There's not an express reference to an Indian tribe or band in the statute or the regs, and I didn't see any case law cited. Is that law clear that the band's water quality standards may be enforced in the same manner as a neighboring state?
Yes, Your Honor. That we in our reply brief we cite. I'll get you the page on a rebuttal. It's City of Albuquerque v. Browner, which was actually basically the same situation where the Pueblo Vizleta was downstream of a discharger, and its water quality standards to protect ceremonial use was imposed on the upstream discharger. And one other site I will get on rebuttal is there's actually in the definitions of the Clean Water Act regulations, it will define a tribe to include a state. So when you see 40 CFR 122.4D, whenever it's talking about a state, that will include a tribe with treatment of state status. And I
but it doesn't say that in 0.4D. I looked at that and it just says all affected states.
Correct. But within the Clean Water Act regulations, the term state is defined to include a tribe. So whenever...
Do I have to look back at the definitions, you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. And okay. I'll get that cite for you on rebuttal.
If the cites are in your reply brief, that's sufficient. But if these are other cases, then we would appreciate that. Any other questions from other judges of Mr. Murdoch? Okay, thank you, Mr. Murdoch. Now we will move to respondents. The first respondent's attorney may introduce himself and his client and begin his argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Bryson Smith, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The North Mountain Mining Project is the most carefully considered mining project in Minnesota history. The environmental review process began in 2005 and spanned an entire decade, culminating in a final environmental impact statement that no one challenged. Following this extensive environmental review process, PolyMet submitted a number of permit applications, including an application for the NPDES permit challenged in this action. PCA, working in close coordination with EPA, subsequently led a 2+ year permitting process that included an unprecedented level of public outreach. In December 2018, PCA issued the permit, which covers nearly 500 pages and is accompanied by a 217-page fact sheet. On the same day that it issued the NPDES permit, PCA also issued a denial of relators' contested case petitions. This denial was accompanied by extensive findings and conclusions with explicit references to the unchallenged FBIS and to PCA's responses to comments received during the permitting process. In short, the PCA commissioner properly exercised discretion to find that relators' petitions merely rehashed previously addressed information and that these petitions therefore presented no information that would aid in the decision-making process. What we're left with is a robust and protective permit. Indeed, a permit that will capture legacy seepage from an existing mining facility and improve downstream water quality, all while allowing for the extraction of minerals that are essential to the green economy. There is no merit to relators' assertions that the permit violates statutory or regulatory requirements. In particular, PCA properly concluded that Q-bells are unnecessary given the lack of reasonable potential to cause or contribute to exceedances of water quality standards. Likewise, there is no need to remand for a functional equivalent analysis because there are no permanent discharges to groundwater, let alone discharges to groundwater that reach surface water. Finally, as the district court properly concluded following a 7-day trial, there is no basis to relators' accusations that PCA sought to suppress EPA's comments or omit evidence from the administrative record. PCA led a procedurally robust permitting process, which resulted in a permit that fully complies with the Clean Water Act and Minnesota law. And Your Honor, I'd like to touch on the Maui issue that was discussed earlier with Ms. McAbee. As a threshold matter, in order for the functional equivalent analysis to be in play at all, you need to have discharges to groundwater that subsequently reach surface water. Here, we don't even have permitted discharges to groundwater. Page 115 of the permit expressly prohibits any discharges that are not specifically authorized under the permit. And this permit does not specifically authorize any groundwater discharges. Therefore, you do not have that predicate. That's a big distinction from both Maui and the U.S. Steel case. Ms. McAbee states that the permit in U.S. Steel has the same quote-unquote boilerplate language that this permit has. But if you look at this court's case prior to the Minnesota Supreme Court case regarding the U.S. Steel case, it expressly says that discharges to groundwater were authorized. That's not the case here.
Mr. Same Smith, can I just clarify your answer to that question? And I'm looking at the definition, at least by Minnesota statute, of discharge means the addition of any pollution to the waters of the state or to any disposal system. And I got understood, perhaps part of Ms. McAbee's answer to that is that it's intentionally discharged through the seepage process. What am I missing, perhaps, in your answer just now that it's specifically prohibited? I know that's what the Polymet Council said in their brief as well, but I'm not fully putting my arms around how those seem like completely in opposite answers. Can you help me out in that regard, please?
Sure, Your Honor. So the Category 1 stockpile and the tailings basin both have confined containment systems where there will be some seepage to groundwater within those confined systems. However, those systems are designed so that any discharge there is captured via a containment system with an inward hydraulic gradient and is pumped back to the tailings basin or to the wastewater treatment stream. So in other words, it's part of the mining facility. It's not a case where you have discharges to groundwater out in the environment at large. It's all part of the contained facility.
And so a containment system is not equivalent of a disposal system as the statute defines. Is that part of your point with regard to those two sites?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at Minnesota Rule 7060.600 subpart 3, it actually talks about discharges to groundwater being permissible so long as there are control measures in place to ensure that there is not pollution or an adverse impact on the potable water supply. And that's certainly the case here because, again, you have a contained, discrete containment system that is part of the mining facility and no discharges are allowed to go beyond that.
Mr. Smith, to help me understand this, so I'm looking at the fact sheet, page 63, table 13. You may or may not have committed that to memory, but it's titled potential non-point discharge to groundwater, and it has a few different places in the facility and flow rates, in fairly low gallons per minute. But doesn't that acknowledge that there is some seepage to the groundwater, and is that sufficient then to show that the functional equivalent analysis is necessary?
No, Your Honor. I have 2 points on that. First of all, is that the acknowledgement of 20 gallons per minute being discharged, that's a conservative assumption. And even under that conservative assumption, that's a tremendous reduction from the existing seepage that you have under the legacy mining site. So it's actually a huge improvement, even if you take those conservative assumptions. But again, that's a conservative assumption, not necessarily indicative of what's predicted to occur. Moreover, it's important to remind the fact that it's not sufficient just to have a discharge to groundwater. In order to implicate the Maui analysis, you need to have that discharge to groundwater subsequently reach surface water. Here, there are robust engineering controls in place to ensure that does not happen. If you look to the fact sheet, pages 62 through 73, it summarizes those various controls, beginning with the seepage containment system and the various liners to, again, prevent discharge to groundwater at all. Moreover, if there are any accidental discharges to groundwater, there are extensive monitoring requirements, annual evaluation requirements, and adaptive management, as well as the reopener clause under permit page 66, which allows PCA to come in and impose corrective action to ensure that none of these discharges reach surface water. And the PCA actually expressly found at pages 62 and 63 of the fact sheet that to the extent there are any accidental discharges to groundwater, they will be detected in time to ensure that they never reach surface water, thereby never implicating the Maui analysis.
To follow up on that, I can't find it now, but I recall a table somewhere showing the estimated amount of time before certain groundwater seepages would reach surface waters. And I recall time periods such as 20, 30 or years or more. I mean, it wasn't that acknowledged somewhere in the record or in the fact sheet? And so, I mean, is your argument that that's just too attenuated in time or what?
Your Honor, our primary argument is that those modeling, yes, it is in the record modeling, analyzing what would happen if there were discharges, how long would it take to reach surface water? Again, those are modeling under worst case scenario situations, conservative assumptions to analyze what would happen if things do not go according to plan. Relators try to weaponize that in a manner to show that the agency somehow is acknowledging or admitting that this is going to have adverse impacts on water quality. That's just not the case. The agency is doing its due diligence and putting in place multiple safeguards to ensure that, yes, we think things are going to go according to plan and there will not be discharges to groundwater. But even if that's not the case, it will take decades for that discharge, even if nothing's done about it, to reach surface water. And in that those decades of time, there's plenty of time to go in under the reopener clause and impose corrective action so that those discharges can be stopped and never reach surface water.
Well, I guess my question then is, doesn't that acknowledgement of the possibility in the distant future of discharges from groundwater to surface water, is that enough to trigger the need for the functional equivalence analysis?
No, Your Honor. Again, in both Maui and U.S. Steel, it was a known fact. These were both existing facilities, and it was known that there were discharges to groundwater that were imminently reaching surface water. That's not the case here. First of all, the PolyMet facility has not been built yet. And again, to the extent you're looking at the existing facility, this is going to impose a huge improvement on the water situation because you're going to have these engineering controls that prevent any discharge. And again, the fact that the agency looked at what would happen if nothing is done does not at all mean that the agency won't do anything to the extent there are accidental discharges to groundwater. So the idea that there are discharges to groundwater that reach surface water is entirely speculative, and we would submit does not create the need to conduct this functional equivalent analysis.
Okay. Mr. Smith, if I may, turn back to the water quality-based effluent limits. One of the respondents says, well, even if they're not required by the CW, the Clean Water Act, because of the reasonable potential analysis, they're required under state law. They cite to Minnesota Statute 115.03. I didn't see you respond to that in your brief. I know there's over 300,000 pages in this record, so perhaps the agency responded them to it somewhere else, and I didn't catch that. But could you either point us to where you did respond to it, or do so now, please?
Sure, Your Honor. So the BCA did not necessarily respond to each issue as the way relators framed the issues, but in an overarching manner, the BCA did respond to the point that that basically dovetails. It coincides with the reasonable potential analysis because that provision states that Q-bells are required when there would be an interference with water quality standards, which is essentially the same as, contributing or causing water quality exceedances. And that's not the case here. Again, on fact sheet pages 31 to 39, it summarizes the robust functional or reasonable potential analysis that the agency conducted here, the pilot testing, the design modeling. And, this goes to extensive technical matters that are subject to the agency's expertise, and we would submit are entitled to deference under Annandale, Alexandria Lake, and in re excess surplus.
On that question, PolyMet did address that statute specifically. Do you agree with the analysis, PolyMet's analysis there?
Yes, Your Honor, we do agree with their analysis. If I might touch on the bentonite issue that Ms. Larson raised, the DNR's permit to mine was challenged, and the Minnesota Supreme Court remanded for a contested case hearing as to whether bentonite is a workable and practicable reclamation technique. Here, we're not dealing with reclamation at all. That's solely within DNR's province. This is a five-year mining permit regarding water quality standards. And so the issues that were implicated in the DNR decision simply not at play here, neither the reclamation statute nor the reactive mine waste rule. Secondly, it is true that the permit and the fact sheet reference bentonite in passing a couple times, but that does not mean that bentonite is a material aspect of this permit. As I said in my intro, the permit spans nearly 500 pages, so it lists everything under the sun that is a part of this project. However, if you'll note in the anti-degradation analysis where it lists bentonite in the bullet points, that's one of many engineering controls that are in place, the primary one of which is the wastewater treatment system and the engineering controls such as the seepage containment system that ensure that there are no unauthorized discharges. If I could touch briefly on it.
Before you do, I apologize, but I'm still hanging on to your distinction of the Maui, and I want to make sure I understand or clarify your main point, which is the combination of this analysis by the agency and the fact that it's not built suggests that Maui's not implicated. So my question is, hypothetically, your point being, if the well where in which water was being injected or discharged into in Maui was being planned And there was an argument raised in opposition to the agency that it's not reaching the Pacific Ocean. Your point being that the Maui functional equivalent would not have been required. And that's why you're saying that in our case, because your agency's analysis has been that it won't reach navigable waters, and that's absent the functional equivalent test. But you also said because it hasn't been built and there's no, the worst case scenario suggests, and then you said it was a conservative assessment. Can you just explain that one more time for me, please? I appreciate that.
Sure, Your Honor. So it's two things primarily. One, there are no authorized discharges to groundwater. Second, there are significant, robust engineering controls in place to ensure that there are no discharges to groundwater. And to the extent there are accidental discharges to groundwater, that they are captured in time to ensure that they never reach surface water. That is a critical distinction from both Maui and U.S. Steel, where you had known discharges, authorized discharges to groundwater that were known to be in short order reaching surface water. To the extent, again, that it turns out, again, there's extensive monitoring in place, so that if for some reason it turns out that there are discharges to groundwater, MPCA can come in and impose corrective action. We would submit that that's the proper way to address this situation, as opposed to conducting an ex ante analysis of a speculative scenario that is not supposed to happen in the first place.
Mr. Smith, to get to the rationale you just, you know, described, wouldn't we be having to find that there are significant robust engineering systems in place? I mean, that's just not what appellate courts usually do. And it seems to me that overall, there's a lot of dispute about whether or not these engineering systems are adequate. Could you—
So, Your Honor, sure. So we would submit that the Maui functional equivalent analysis does not come into play. The court doesn't even need to analyze it, given that you don't have an authorized and known discharge to groundwater that's reaching surface water. Our brief did go a step further and talk about if the court does conduct that analysis, it should find that it's not the functional equivalent. But our main position is that as a threshold matter, that functional equivalent analysis is not triggered because you do not have that authorized known discharge that ultimately reaches surface water.
Mr. Smith, I have a question about the permits measuring at WS-74 or SD-1 as opposed to the end of the pipes at SD-2 through 11. I think that Regulation 122.45 applies, and it generally says that these limitations shall be established at each outfall or discharge point, except with two exceptions, including whether it's infeasible or impractical. Are you relying on that exception for infeasible and impractical? And if so, why is that exception met, and where is that in the record?
No, Your Honor, the agency is not relying on that exception. So the fundamental issue with QBELS is under 40 CFR 122.44D, if the agency determines that there is not reasonable potential for water quality exceedances, there is no need for QBELS. And as evidenced by the robust record here, the agency properly reached that conclusion that there is no reasonable potential and therefore decided that QBELS are not necessary, full stop. Having said that, the agency—
So you're saying that 122.45 only applies to QBELS. What WQBELS, it does not apply to the operating limits that you've imposed?
So I think the operating limits would apply, and it's actually for that one, 40 CFR 122.45E as an operation and maintenance control. And it's essentially an extra safeguard that the agency imposed to ensure that the wastewater treatment facility is functioning as planned. Relators try to say that the agency is trying to use operating limits in lieu of QBELS when QBELS would somehow otherwise be required. That's not the case. QBELS are not required here because the functional or the reasonable potential analysis indicated that there is no reasonable potential. However, you know, the agency went the extra mile above and beyond statutory and regulatory requirements to impose operating limits, as well as the narrative water quality standards, as well as the reopener clause at page 66 of the permit.
I have another question about whether the relators make the assertion that the operating limits are not enforceable under the Clean Water Act. And in your brief, you've said that they are. Can you explain that? I'm unclear about the difference between the parties' positions on that issue, but maybe if you could, in a short, pithy minute or two, help me understand that issue.
Sure, Your Honor. So under 40 CFR 122.45E, operation maintenance controls are authorized under the Clean Water Act. That's what the agency did with the operating limits here. Additionally, under 33 USC 1319, any condition under a state-issued NPDES permit can be enforced by a federal agency, EPA in this case. I would also direct the court to the Panyard case from the Sixth Circuit that likewise held that any condition under a state-issued NPDES permit is enforceable. So for all of these reasons, we would contend that operating limits are enforceable under federal law. Moreover, there's no dispute among the parties that they're absolutely enforceable under state law. And again, this is all above and beyond what was required. Because there's no reasonable potential, QBELs weren't required in the first place, but the agency tacked on the operating limits as an additional precaution to make sure that everything is going according to plan. I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to answer any further questions that the court may have.
It appears there are none. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Counsel for PolyMet may introduce yourself, your client, and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Jay Johnson, and I'm here representing PolyMet Mining. As PCA's counsel mentioned, PolyMet's mine has been more thoroughly reviewed than any other mine in Minnesota history. The results of that review are three features that are key in this case. One, PolyMet's permit accounts for remote risks with extra protections. Two, PolyMet's permit prohibits groundwater discharges. And three, PolyMet's project cleans up existing pollution, lowering the amount of mercury in the watershed and removing 1,400 metric tons of sulfate every year. The relators refuse to accept those facts. They want this court to view PCA's actions with suspicion instead of deference. But as a matter of constitutional separation of powers, the court owes PCA's decision a presumption of correctness. With that said, I'd like to start addressing some of the points that relators raised and whatever questions the court may have. I'd start with MCEA's claim that the requirements under the permit to mine rules and under PCA's water quality rules are substantially similar. That is not at all true. The permit to mine rules are specific to non-ferrous mining, and they specifically require certain things related to mine waste. PCA's rules cover any discharge to any waters of the state. So comparing the bentonite requirements as they were applied by the Supreme Court in the permit in the NorthMet case to the brief mentions of bentonite as a descriptive matter in this case, I think is inappropriate. And certainly the NorthMet case is not precedential here. MCEA also said, I believe, that when the district court was considering what were the unlawful procedures here, that they characterized the district court as finding that the unlawful procedures resulted in an inadequate record. That is not what the district court found. The district court found the opposite of that, that in fact, the procedures in this case did not affect the record, and that the relators now have everything that could have been in the record, and they can make whatever arguments they want to make in this court about how the record affects their arguments. On the County of Maui, I think one important thing to do in this case is to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in County of Maui, because that decision actually emphasizes, and I'm quoting it here, Congress left general groundwater regulatory authority to the states. And it elsewhere says that the states have, quote, substantial responsibility and autonomy over groundwater. How I think that applies here is twofold. One, as counsel for PCA was saying, the discharges in this case are not permitted. State law in Minnesota prohibits all discharges to groundwater unless they're permitted. And in this case, they aren't permitted. Nothing in the permit allows groundwater discharges. In Maui, and you can see this on page 7 of the respondent's brief in that case, the county held an underground injection control permit under Hawaii law that specifically authorized discharges to groundwater. And with the MNTAC permit that Water Legacies Council was referring to, and I think this was mentioned by PCA's council as well, the Court of Appeals decision, U.S. Steel, specifically says that groundwater discharges were authorized. Here, they aren't authorized. The second distinction, the second reason I think that County of Maui's responsibility and autonomy holding matters here is all the discussion that was had over what happens if some water that's not permitted escapes containment or goes through an impermeable liner or whatever other unpermitted discharges might occur. And I think the answer is, if you look at what the Supreme Court said, the state has responsibility and autonomy to deal with those kinds of state permit violations. It's not a question of whether the Clean Water Act whether it needs to be considered under the federal Clean Water Act, that these unpermitted state discharges might be the functional equivalent of a direct discharge to surface water.
As Mr. Johnson, in your brief, you made reference to, you're summarizing now too what you said, but part of what you said is that no discharges were allowed except to operate a disposal system that will discharge to certain wetlands and the headwaters. And then you list the unnamed creek, Trimble Creek, and headwater of Second Creek. How do I square that with what you just said? And Mr. Smith just said too, that there's no discharge, but you said by the permit itself, it's allowed. Would that not implicate the Maui requirement?
Well, you're right, Your Honor. There are permitted discharges in PolyMet's permit, but those are all permitted surface water discharges. There are 10 or 11 of them to the places that you mentioned. Those are not permitted groundwater discharges. Those are the discharges of the treated water from surface discharge one that spreads out to the various different places where surface water discharges are authorized. None of those discharges are groundwater discharges. And our point is that the permit doesn't authorize any groundwater discharges.
And so if I understand then fully, thank you for that explanation, because it's treated, it's therefore not a pollutant entering, as was the case in the Maui scenario.
Well, yeah, in the Maui scenario, there was discharge to groundwater that was permitted. What I'm saying is that the treated discharges here aren't to groundwater at all. They're only to surface water. So that's what distinguishes the Maui situation from PolyMet's situation.
Is the difference between the parties' arguments here a matter of definition of discharge? And is there a different definition for discharge to groundwater as opposed to discharge to surface water? And as I'm looking at the EPA regs, I mean, maybe it's natural that they define discharges to surface waters, but so then do we look to state law to determine what is a discharge to groundwater?
That's exactly what you should do, Your Honor. And I think we cite the state rules in our briefs, and I believe that the state rules define discharge as any addition of pollutants to any waters of the state. And waters of the state in state law includes groundwater. So it goes back to what the Supreme Court said. Congress gave states general regulatory authority over groundwater. And further, the Minnesota state law prohibits discharges to groundwater unless they're specifically authorized. And again, there are no specific authorizations in this permit to discharge to groundwater. There just aren't.
So I mean, I'm having difficulty reconciling that with what I was referring to earlier. The fact sheet acknowledges that there will be some seepage at relatively low rates of gallons per minute to the groundwater. So that will occur, but yet you say that there are no permitted discharges to groundwater, but yet there are some acknowledged potential seepage to groundwater. So how do I reconcile those different things?
So it goes back to what I tried to open with about there are remote risks that are dealt with extra protections in this permit. What the table says, I believe, is that these are potential non-point source discharges. And that goes back, they're taking this table out of the final EIS. And the final EIS made extraordinarily conservative assumptions about what might happen. So again, every single risk of potential pollution would be accounted for. What the modeling shows, and the fact sheet says this too, is that there won't be any discharges to surface water via groundwater. There's an impermeable liner in one place. There's an inward hydraulic gradient in one place that protects. So I read the tables as possible unpermitted discharges. And on top of those assumptions, that's why the permit contains so much monitoring, so that if something goes wrong, an unpermitted discharge happens, the state can exercise its responsibility and autonomy, as the Supreme Court says in Maui, to correct the situation. It's not an admission that these discharges are going to happen. It's accounting for the possibility that something unpermitted does happen.
Mr. Johnson, if I may, you just mentioned the ongoing monitoring, and I know just reading the permit, there is a lot of that going on, both in kind of monitoring that your company's doing, as well as annual reports, I believe, that the agency's doing. Is there anything, I didn't see it in the permit, but as I said earlier, there are over, 300,000 pages in this record. Is there anything that talks about kind of how that information will be shared? I think just given some of the transparency concerns that came up as in the proceeding before Judge Guthman, you know, is there anything that says, and these Republican people will be able to be comments on them? Is there anything like that in this record?
I don't have a specific say for you on that, Your Honor, but I will say that the annual groundwater reports for certain are going to be made public. The monitoring data is always shared with PCA, and it's ComEd is obligated to share that data. So this isn't just PolyMet watching the monitoring wells. This is PolyMet sharing its data with PCA, and again, PCA exercising its responsibility as the groundwater regulatory authority to handle whatever might be found. To what extent all of that might be public, you know, I guess I would say, you know, it's not normally the case that agencies make their every permitting monitoring situation public, but there are opportunities for public information in this permit. I want to turn to another point here. I want to talk about some questions that were asked about danger signals. I think Judge Jessen asked that question. And I do think it goes back to the big picture, the overarching deference that is owed to the agency in a situation like this. It can't be the case that the fact that an agency commented in the EIS, which was never challenged, is a danger signal that there's some sort of improper agency action. That reverses the presumption of correctness and puts the burden on the agency to prove that what it's doing is right. You know, to the extent there are disagreements about what the engineering controls are and how they would work, I would say it's all in the record. The agency talks extensively in its fact sheet about what the engineering controls are and why they will work. And it's on the relators to disprove that. They have to show that those discussions aren't supported by substantial evidence. And I don't even think they've tried to show that. They just say they don't like what's in the engineering controls, or they claim that they won't work, but there's no showing that the findings of the agency aren't supported by substantial evidence. And I think the same goes for the Q-Bells discussion. I think everyone agrees I think you can read this in the relator's opening briefs. I wrote down Fond du Lac's brief on 50, MCEA's brief on 53, and Water Legacy's brief on 14 and 15. Everyone agrees that if there's no reasonable potential, there doesn't have to be a Q-bell. That's the end of the game for the Q-bells argument, because PCA found no reasonable potential, and that's finding is supported by substantial evidence.
If I may, Mr. Johnson, but that, I think my questions about danger signals really was because I think that in addition to kind of the substantial evidence analysis, there's also can be this arbitrary and capricious analysis. And when I was looking at the NorthMet case from the Supreme Court earlier this year, I noticed that in that case, they even distinguished that In re Owatonna case, who said, look, in that situation, there were some other concerns, you know, and, you know, that maybe said, you know, enough. Made one question, kind of just a straight analysis of the substantial evidence test. And that, from my perspective, and perhaps you can comment on this, is why I'm trying to say, is there enough here as far as arguably pushing the EPA not to submit written comments to say there are those sorts of concerns which should make us either take a harder look at the substantial evidence or to say, are there other things that go with that to say they're danger signals?
Well, I don't think there's any case that I'm aware of that says danger signals raise the substantial evidence requirement. Substantial evidence is substantial evidence. There are cases, of course, that say if there are enough danger signals, then it could suggest an arbitrary and capricious agency action. But as Your Honor suggested in her question, I don't think that there are really any danger signals here, because where the other side is pulling their danger signals is basically rejecting the factual findings that have to be reviewed for clear error from the district court. The district court didn't find that EPA thought there was a problem with this permit. The district court found that EPA chose not to submit a letter and that EPA had substantial other opportunities to comment and didn't comment, and that EPA could have objected and didn't object. And that EPA and PCA met dozens of times over the course of 2 years to talk about this permit. So it seems to me, and let me add, that it rejected Relator's argument that there was some sort of overarching effort to prevent EPA from commenting. As a matter of fact, that didn't happen. So I think on the whole, that record says there aren't danger signals.
Mr. Johnson, I earlier asked Ms. McAbee about the EPA's reasons for suggesting, recommending, however you want to say it, WQ bills. Do you have your own view of an answer to that question?
Well, I basically agree with the premise of Your Honor's question in terms of what EPA was asking. I don't think EPA was suggesting that PCA was wrong in its reasonable potential analysis. And, you know, that's borne out by the fact that EPA never objected to the permit. And as I said a few moments ago, if there's no reasonable potential, there's nothing that required PCA to implement Q-bells. And I don't think there's a dispute about that. So the question here is, does the fact that PCA did more somehow undermine the finding of no reasonable potential? And I don't think it can do that.
Am I correct in assuming that the law allows an agency like PCA to impose WQ bells even if there is no reasonable potential?
I believe the law would allow that. I suppose PolyMet might have an opportunity to object. And I would say that in this case, PCA did do more and it implemented its operating limits that, you know, have an additional back, you know, additional protection for the water, despite the finding that PolyMet's treatment system will not discharge at levels above water quality standards.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. It appears there are no further questions for you. Now is the time for relators to make their rebuttal arguments. And as I stated earlier, each attorney has an allocation of 5 minutes for rebuttal. So I will turn to the first relator's attorney, whoever that may be, for a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Judge Johnson. Elise Larson. I'd like to first start
And could you repeat, just for those who may have joined late, could you please again say your client or clients?
Yes, Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness, and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy are my clients. I would first like to answer the question about my clients raising the bentonite issue in our contested case hearing petition. I would point the court to footnote 13 in our brief, where we cite record site 1254, 1265, and 1284 to 85. I would also point the court to record site 5500, which is MPCA's responses to comments, where our assertions with regard to the inadequacy of the bentonite amendment appear, and MPCA does not respond to the substance of that comment. With respect to the bentonite amendment not being pivotal because this is a five-year permit, or this that MPCA does not apply the reactive mine waste rule, I would say that those arguments are not supported by Minnesota law. In Minnesota, we require permittees to design a project from the beginning that is going to comply with the law from beginning to end. We do not permit first and ask questions later. And I would point the court to 7001.0150 for what is required for a permit application. And as set forth in my initial argument with regard to whether the bentonite amendment goes to major issues in this permit, the modeling assumes bentonite will work, and MPCA relied on modeling to say that this containment system is going to be effective and water, only a small amount of water is getting past the containment system. All of these facts that MPCA is now saying don't go to the Maui analysis, those models assume that the bentonite amendment is going to work. Third, related to the five-year term in Maui, I would like to be explicit that MPCA committed a legal error here. Prior to the Maui decision, MPCA had three decisions on what law to apply with regard to whether the Clean Water Act regulated discharges to the groundwater. One of those was that the Clean Water Act does not regulate anything except a direct discharge into surface water. That is the standard that MPCA applied. That is a legal error. We are entitled to a remand for that legal error, whether or not this is a five-year permit, whether or not MPCA now wants to say that the modeling assumptions that they made are wrong. Moving to the issues of the groundwater, we do look to Minnesota law to determine whether there is a discharge to groundwater. A water of the state is all groundwater in this state, including the water underneath these disposal systems. There is nothing in the rule that supports MPCA's assertion that because the groundwater is, quote, staying within the mining facility, that that groundwater somehow does not count. And MPCA's assertions that the containment system is a control measure is not supported by the rule. A control measure is something that ensures pollutants will not constitute or continue to be a source of pollution under subpart 3. Nothing about this containment system is going to ensure that 2,000 acres of groundwater do not end up being polluted for hundreds of years. The containment system simply corrals that water and hopes to prevent that it's not going to spread to other groundwater systems. That is what the containment system does. Third, the permit says that they the permit provides that this that these containment systems may leak. And I would point this court to site 5224 to 26, 5230, and 5352 for showing that these containment systems are going to leak. And with regard to corrective actions, the fact that you can implement a corrective action does not absolve the groundwater issues here. We are not a permit first and ask questions later state. That's precisely how you end up with a MNTAC type facility, is if we don't ask these questions at the beginning. Finally, with regard to the unchallenged FEIS, I would point to our briefs. that adequate and adequate FEIS and MPCA's obligations for permitting are wholly different. And the fact that the FEIS is unchallenged does not fix that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. The second relator's attorney may present rebuttal argument. Again, please identify yourself and your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Paula McAbee for Water Legacy. With respect to the standard deference analysis, the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that it accords deference, quote unquote, on a case-by-case basis, and that's in Annandale at 525. In this record, there is no basis for deference. Judge Jessen asked about danger signals. In this case, they're not danger signals. They're loud klaxons. First, MPCA failed to resolve EPA's deficiency letter, which said that groundwater pollution that would affect surface water would not be covered. Second, MPCA made a completely unprecedented request to EPA to withhold EPA's comments. Then MPCA destroyed all the emails and records of those requests to EPA. And the MPCA can't pat itself on the back that we now have a complete record, because we had to file 9 FOIA requests, 2 FOIA lawsuits, and then the judge had to order disclosure of the attorney's records for us to have any idea what was really happening. And then the MPCA hid and discarded notes of the April meeting where EPA read its comments and told the courts that and us that and the public that they had not asked EPA to withhold its comments and that they had no records. So the failure to respond to EPA's concerns is just one of the many events leading up to it. And Judge Jessen, I don't know if this is typical for the MPCA. I certainly hope not. But in this case, MPCA is not owed discretion in its particular dealings with PolyMet. And here, MPCA adopted interpretations of law without addressing EPA's concerns, without addressing the Great Lakes Initiative. And many of the arguments made by counsel today, for example, that operating limits are under the Clean Water Act, in the permit, the operating limits are authorized only under state law for disposal systems. These are new legal interpretations that are not entitled to any deference under the Supreme Court's opinions. And we keep on coming back to the issue of Q-bills. I hope our briefs have made it clear that Water Legacy believes that for mercury, any detectable discharge has reasonable potential. That's what the GLI says. That's what the rules say. And also, MPCA is not allowed to let PolyMet discharge pollutants to impaired waters. The Clean Water Act prevents that. And actually, so does the Annandale case and Alexandria case, although it has a typo on the actual statute. And now, one more thing about to understand about Maui. I agree with Ms. Larson that this permit contemplated discharge to groundwater and through groundwater to surface water. That's all through the EIS. And the EIS specifically said they expected that 10% of the groundwater would not be captured at the tailings basin, and said that the current south seepage system, which the permit doesn't improve, discharges through groundwater to immediately adjacent wetlands in Second Creek. Now, I want to say also, I was a counsel in the MNTAC case. There's nothing in the MNTAC permit that specifically permitted discharges to groundwater. As a matter of fact, the North Met permit is much more specific because it cites each potential point source of pollution and then says that only direct discharge is prohibited. So it is really clear on this record that Maui analysis was not done. The PCA assumed the only thing it had to do was prohibit direct discharge to surface waters. And there is a strong likelihood that there would be pollution through groundwater from the North Met pollution sources that would violate water quality standards. To Judge Johnson's question about where the EPA talks about the Great Lakes Initiative and reasonable potential, that is in page 2 of 7. I think it's in our addendum at page 5. And there are other issues that if you review that letter and realize that they're not just relators' arguments, they are arguments that the regulator with the most expertise has also made. Finally, there's no way that federal courts on a clean water lawsuit can correct deficiencies in the permit. There's only one authority that can fix an adequate NPDES permit and protect Minnesota waters in accordance with law. It is this court. We respectfully request that this court exercise this authority and reverse and remand the permit to fix the process and to fix the outcome so that Minnesota waters will be protected from our first proposed copper nickel sulfide mine. Thank you. Did I miss a question? I apologize if I did.
If I may, Judge Johnson.
Yes, you may.
Okay. Ms. McAmey, we had talked earlier about the options if we were to reverse, and one of them being if we were to reverse and remand for a new public comment period. I think that was a hypothetical that several of you addressed with us. Could you discuss what that scope of that public comment period should be? I mean, would it be on the entire permit, or would it be, I mean, and this is all hypothetical, not saying the panel would do this, but or should it really be focused on the water quality-based effluent limits, which of course would include the Great Lake Initiative, as I understand it. Could you address that for me?
Thank you, Your Honor. It is our perception that the scope of the public comments would have to be both on the issue of water quality-based effluent limits, which is why I keep calling them QBELs, and on the outcome of the Maui analysis. Now, we don't know whether the Maui analysis will lead to QBELs, will lead to design changes, or will just lead to more information. And many of the issues that Ms. Larson raised as contested case issues may survive and require the same kind of dispute and factual evidence that she raises today. So at the very least, we believe that a new permit and comment period should be authorized to address QBELs and a Maui analysis. And it appears from the OIG report that the EPA is likely this time to participate in its normal, customary, established way. And we would hope that there would be no barriers to the MPCA accepting those comments and then responding to them in writing so that the public and the courts know what their reactions are.
Ms. McAbee, Mr. Johnson argued that if there is no reasonable potential, if that analysis is correct, then that essentially cuts off the analytical path to any conclusion that WQBELs are required. Do you agree with that? Or is there any issue or sub-issue that where the analysis does not depend upon your sort of overturning the agency's determination of no reasonable potential?
Your Honor, there are three areas where I think that Mr. Johnson's analysis is incorrect as a matter of law. First, for discharge of detectable mercury from the wastewater treatment plant to waters that are impaired for fish tissue, the law itself, the Great Lakes Initiative, and the Minnesota rules say that just detectable mercury has the reasonable potential to cause or contribute to violation of water quality standards. So that's a cutout where any generic reasonable potential doesn't apply. Similarly, under the Clean Water Act and in the regulations at 122.4i, if the water, and there's a similar regulation in Minnesota law, a similar statute, if there's going to be discharge of a pollutant to impaired waters, that discharge causes or contributes to a violation of water quality standards unless there is a limitation on load and compliance. And what Alexandria Lake and Annandale have, and Annandale in more detail have explained, is that the QBEL is the mechanism. And if you look at Alexandria Lake, Table 1 shows how all the QBELs were used to find that the discharge was allowable. And then I would finally say, Your Honor, that the question about whether reasonable potential is adequate is not just a substantial evidence test, because the MPCA was required under the Great Lakes Initiative and its own contract that gives it the authority to issue QBELs. In 2000, the MPCA amended the Memorandum of Agreement to say that it had to use GLI procedures, which are more protective. And EPA has been emphasizing that not just in its recent comment, its March 2018 comments, but throughout the environmental review process, that the statistics for permitting are more stringent than those that are okay for an environmental review.
Thank you for that. I have one quick follow-up on your first point about mercury and fish. And I think you're referring to rules 7052-0220 subpart 7.
Yes, sir.
Which says that each facility that discharges detectable levels of such pollutant to that water has the reasonable potential. And my understanding is that the discharges here are to the three creeks, but the three creeks do not have mercury in fish tissue. It's other rivers that are downstream. So, I mean, it seems like that rule is very specific in focusing on that water. So does that apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason it applies in this case is because both under the Clean Water Act and under Minnesota statutes, the definition of discharge is the addition of any pollutant to any water body, any surface water body. They use either navigable or waters of the state. And so if the PolyMet, just like in the Maui case, you know, the Supreme Court said you could push back a pipe a number of feet and it wouldn't change it. The discharge to the headwaters of the Embarrass River, if any of that pollution is going to get to the Embarrass River, it's this discharge of detectable pollution to the Embarrass River. And a really good case to point that out is the Winstead case, because the MPCA didn't have enough data on the immediately proximate reaches. It was only going further downstream that they had enough data to then set the Q-bell. And if I quoted this in our reply brief, unfortunately, I can't remember the page of the citation, but the EPA explained that the purpose of this rule that you just quoted, which is the same as the GLI rule, was to expand reasonable potential, not to contract it, so that even detectable pollutants would trigger the requirement for a water quality-based effluent limit.
Thank you, Ms. McAbee. Are there any other questions by other judges for Ms. McAbee? It appears not. Thank you very much. And finally, we will hear rebuttal argument from the third relator's attorney. Again, please identify yourself and your client.
Thank you, Your Honor. Matthew Murdoch for the Fond du Lac Band. Just briefly, Judge Johnson, the sites on which you had asked about earlier about the band's status as a state under the Clean Water Act, page 33 of our reply brief, we'll cite those cases. I direct you specifically to, or Your Honor, to Albuquerque v. Browner, which in that case, a downstream tribe, those standards were imposed on an upstream discharger. And that's exactly what EPA told MPCA here, was that they had to ensure compliance. And then 40 CFR 122.2 is the definitions for the Clean Water Act regulations. And if you scroll down, you'll see state is defined to include a tribe that meets requirements in another regulation, which means treatment of state. And so the ban satisfies that definition. And I do want to touch on the question of the scope of the remand, because you know MPCA committed a legal error here by not even acknowledging that it had a legal duty to ensure compliance with the band's water quality standards, as required by 40 CFR 122.4D. So when we talk about the reasonable potential analysis, you know, Mr. Johnson for PolyMet said we're limited to substantial evidence. Well, we claim a lot more than that. MPCA never even did a reasonable potential analysis for the band's water quality standards, which is how it could even satisfy its duty to ensure compliance with the band's water quality standards. And that's a serious concern for mercury and methylmercury, because the effects of those pollutants actually increase downstream because they don't break down in the environment. They're persistent and they accumulate in aquatic life and the humans and wildlife who consume mercury contaminated fish. And so the effects of PolyMet's discharges will manifest themselves far downstream, including in the band's waters. And so that's clearly one issue that we definitely take with the reasonable potential analysis. And
Mr. Murdoch, can you just briefly summarize how the band's water quality standards are different from the state of Minnesota?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically with respect to mercury, it's about half in terms of mercury concentration. It's much lower than Minnesota's. And it's much lower because it's calculated to support band members in subsistence fishing. They consume substantially more fish as part of their cultural and religious traditions. And so that's why it's a more protective standard. And it's been exceeded for for some time now. It's much higher than it needs to be to satisfy that designated use. And so that's another area where the band standards are lower. It's just the designated use for subsistence fishing requires a lower mercury concentration in fish to, again, support these uses. And those water quality standards have the status of federal law because they've been approved by EPA. And then
what about sulfate?
Sulfate is also different because the ban does not limit that to seasonal application. MPCA applies it seasonally. The ban applies it year round, again, because the seeding of the wild rice, it's not just a seasonal thing. So that's also different.
Is it different from 10 units?
No, it's the exact concentration. It just applies year round, which becomes an issue here because PolyMet's own data shows an exceedance of the 10 concentration. EPA's longstanding guidance shows that's sufficient to have reasonable potential. So the fact that the ban standard applies year round is a bigger issue because we're not looking at just a seasonal application. To take the reasonable potential again, it's just not a substantial evidence question. Aside from the band standard, MPCA committed a legal error. It never even considered effluent variability with respect to mercury. MPCA's conclusion of no reasonable potential for mercury relies on nothing more than an assumption that's completely contradicted by the record. MPCA in its brief to this court made an incredible statement at page 21 that the sulfate removal rate in PolyMet's treatment system is comparable to the rate for mercury. In fact, however, PolyMet's pilot study was inconclusive for mercury, and it admitted that the treatment system was, quote, highly variable and mercury removal is difficult to quantify. And that's the exact comment that Ms. McAbee referenced that the EPA made about the reasonable potential. They highlighted the same deficiency, that the pilot study basically contradicts a conclusion of no reasonable potential, which is not a particularly high standard. And if I just briefly touch on County of Maui, one thing that might get lost is, Ms. Larson mentioned the legal error. That legal error is actually in the permit. This is at record 5768, section 5.175.51. That's a direct discharge. Again, that's an erroneous legal interpretation that is in the permit itself. And that's why reversal and remand is necessary too.
If I may.
Excuse me. Yes, you may, Judge Jessen.
I just want to go back to your argument about the water quality standards and the band having and the reasonable potential analysis and was one done for the band. I mean, when I'm looking at this, the MPCA, I think on the permit sheet states that the project is designed does not have the reasonable potential to cause or contribute to any violations of applicable water quality standards in the waters of our state. I mean, I take it you're saying they need to be more specific and address the ban specifically. I just want to make sure I understand your argument and any support you have for that. That broad language, given our deference, isn't enough.
Yes, Your Honor. I would read that statement you just read as ensuring compliance with the waters of Minnesota. And so under 40 CFR 122.4D, in this case, the ban is an affected state. And so MPC has a legal obligation to also ensure compliance with the ban's water quality standards. And that was also, that's what EPA was telling MPCA to do. And MPCA just completely disregarded it. That statement is not, I would not construe that as referencing the ban standards.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murdoch. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case was exceptionally well presented, both in writing and orally, and the court appreciates that. It helps us do our task. So the case is now submitted. The court's rules call for us to issue an opinion in writing within 90 days, and we will proceed to do that.